Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. First, the destructive flooding in eastern Kentucky. The aftermath is extensive, and it will take a lot of time, a lot of effort, and support to recover. If you're looking for a way to pitch in, you can find a link on our website homepage at esweku.org. We're beginning an exploration of the connections between religion and the environment, with climate change front and center in these discussions. What do religious teachings and texts have to say about environmental stewardship in general and climate change in particular? Dr. Leah Shade, Associate Professor of Preaching and Worship at Lexington Theological Seminary and a Lutheran minister, is co-editor and author with Margaret Bullitt Jonas of Rooted and Rising, Voices of Courage in a Time of Climate Crisis. Thanks for joining us, Dr. Shade.
Tom, it's good to be with you.
First, tell us about your book. What's that about?
Margaret and I put together a book that is a collection of 21 essays by religious environmental activists. And we ask them to share with us for their reflections on how they're sustaining themselves in the midst of what I call the dark night of the green soul. As in, you know, we've been working on these issues for decades now, and in many ways, things seem to be getting worse, not better. And so how are they keeping their faith? How are they keeping themselves spiritually strengthened? And where do they find resources to be able to continue this struggle? And so we have essays from across different religions, such as Christianity, Judaism, Islam, Unitarian, Indigenous spirituality, and representing different races, ethnicities, genders, sexual orientations. It's a very diverse group of authors who share their wisdom for this very challenging time.
A section of the book talks about rooting science and policy in faith and spirituality, and the science around climate often comes from the government. How do you navigate that?
Science can tell us the how, but faith and religion can give us the why. It gives us the moral and ethical frameworks that we need to understand the implications of what science teaches us.
What have been the barriers to helping congregations understand that caring for the environment is part and parcel to the teachings of the Bible?
One of the things that is a barrier to people understanding this is that sometimes people don't understand that the Bible is woven throughout with texts about caring for creation. From the very first book of the Bible in Genesis all the way through the end of the Christian scriptures in Revelation, you find lots of stories and texts and teachings about what it means to live in covenantal relationship with God's creation, what it means to take care of the land and the water, what it means to share these gifts in a reciprocal way with each other and with the rest of the earth community so that everyone can thrive. And when congregations begin to understand that environmental issues are not a political thing, but they're really part of what it means to be a person of faith, to take care of what has been entrusted to us by our Creator, then you can see, okay, this is what it means in terms of my calling to be a person of faith, whether you're a Christian or a Muslim or a Jew or Hindu. All of our scriptures speak to this need to care for what God has created.
Among the essays that are contained in the book, are there some important takeaways that might help listeners make that connection between religious teachings and climate science?
Yes, we have actually a number of essays that are written by people who are scientists and who are also people of faith. So the book is actually divided into seven different sections with different themes. And each section has questions to ponder and spiritual practices. And one of the sections, section three, is about rooting science and policy in faith and spirituality. So we have a climate scientist by the name of Dr. Catherine Hayhoe, who talks about science and the imperative of hope. Natasha Desjarnais who is an African American scientist who is studying the effects of climate on public health. She writes about how that impacts communities, especially historically marginalized communities. And then we have a lovely chapter by Corina Newsom, who is a young African-American woman who studies birds and animals and how climate impacts them. And she's also an evangelical Christian. And so she very much connects her responsibility to care for the temple of Earth, so to speak, and her work as a scientist and a biologist.
Well, I know that you've been surveying clergy and congregations about their attitudes towards social issues and ministry. What stands out to you among your findings where climate change is concerned?
One of the things that I've found is that congregations actually want their leaders to give them biblical and theological frameworks to make sense of the climate science and the environmental issues. When clergy don't talk about this and they think that it's quote unquote too political, then it leaves a moral and ethical gap, and parishioners wonder why churches and why congregations aren't speaking to this when it's clearly impacting communities, everything from droughts to wildfires to rising sea levels to acidification of oceans. This is affecting the entire human community. And so when clergy put a theological and biblical lens to this, it says, okay, this is worth caring about. This is worth us doing something about this. I believe that people of faith are really the sleeping giant, so to speak, when it comes to moral and ethical action in terms of responding to climate action and calling on our leaders to do something, to take the necessary steps to draw down our carbon output, to build resilient communities, and to make sure that we are equitably sharing the resources that we have so that impacted communities can thrive.
All right. Well, where can listeners go to find your book?
You can find Rooted and Rising and any of my books anywhere books are sold. So this particular book was published by Roman and Littlefield, so you can go to their website, or you can go to Amazon or your local bookstore, and that's a place where you can order or pick up the book.
All right, that's Dr. Leah Shade, Associate Professor of Preaching and Worship at Lexington Theological Seminary and a Lutheran minister, co-editor and author with Margaret Bullitt Jonas of Rooted and Rising, Voices of Courage in a Time of Climate Crisis. Thank you so much, Dr. Shade.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me on, Tom.
While we're on the subject of religion, one who has devoted a lifetime to ministry recently announced his retirement from one of Lexington's historic downtown congregations, and he talked about it with WEKU's Sam Dick.
Welcome to David Shirey. He is retiring after 40 years in the ministry, 8 of those last years as senior minister at Central Christian Church in downtown Lexington. Welcome.
Thank you, Sam.
Tell us first about this historic church and today's congregation.
Sam, Central Christian here in Lexington was founded in 1816 by a man named Barton Warren Stone, who was a pastor out in Bourbon County, east of Paris, at a congregation called the Cane Ridge Presbyterian Church. And there was a great revival there in the early 1800s, 1801. And from that, Barton Stone came away desiring to work for the unity of the church and really of all creation. He had a heart for reuniting and healing and reconciling. In 1816, he came to Lexington and founded what then was known as the Hill Street Christian Church, whose first building was within a stone's throw of where Rupp Arena is right now, over on High Street. And then in the 1840s, the growing congregation moved to Main Street in Lexington, near Martin Luther King, where the police department is currently located. There's a historic sign there for the Main Street Church. And our current church building was built in 1896 at the corner of East Short and Martin Luther King and became Central Christian Church. So 206 years, and the congregation continues to thrive, to be of service in this location. That decision has been made numerous times to stay downtown. I call it the corner of commerce and need, where we can serve all God's people, and we do. This is a 24/7 congregation that serves people throughout the week who come here for various needs, and then on Sunday morning to worship God and to equip and motivate ourselves to continue that ministry well beyond our walls the rest of the week.
How welcoming is this church to people of all shapes and sizes, colors and backgrounds?
Well, this congregation developed what we call our welcome statement, welcome. We welcome you regardless of your income, your ethnicity, your race, your sexual orientation, whether you're a believer or a seeker, we welcome you here. So this is a congregation that, because it's the way we understand Jesus Christ, whose arms were open and whose ministry reached out to all, has tried to emulate that by welcoming everybody.
Why was this the right time to step aside, to retire?
Oh, Sam. Well, I realized a few years ago, as I was imagining when I would retire, that A, 2022 would be the 50th anniversary of my baptism, which took place at Central Christian Church Disciples of Christ in Warren, Ohio, on Palm Sunday in 1972. It would be the 40th anniversary of my beginning congregational ministry. August 1st of this year completes 40 years of congregational ministry that began at the Carthage Christian Church in Carthage, Tennessee, 60 miles east of Nashville, where I was a 22-year-old student at Vanderbilt Divinity School. Congregation of about 30 people, if I counted every single person I could count. So the end of 50 years of baptism, 40 years of ministry, and 20 years, the past 20 years exactly, have been split between starting a new church from scratch in Phoenix, Arizona, and serving what is one of our oldest churches in our larger church family, the Christian Church Disciples of Christ. And so 50, 40, 20, and of course 40 being such a great biblical number, I just thought it's time to wrap it up and put a bow on it and give thanks for the incredible privilege it's been to be a pastor.
In a message to your congregation, you said you used to think of ministry as a marathon, but you have changed your mind on that.
I had an epiphany that came to me. David, you're a distance runner. You've been a runner your whole life. You think of things in that capacity, and you know that once you start running, you can keep going and going and going. You think of ministry as a marathon. And you just keep going, even if you have to crawl over the finish line on your knees. But the whisper of the Spirit, Sam, was, David, it's not a marathon. It's a relay race. You received the baton from generations of faithful pastors who went before you. Your responsibility in a relay race is to run your leg as fast and hard as you can so that you can hand off to the next person at as close to top speed as possible. You are not serving the team well if you have to walk to the finish line. You're not serving the team well if they have to come back and pick you up and drag you to the finish line. Somebody said it's better that they ask why did he retire than why don't he retire. So I decided, you know what? That is a wonderful insight. And I looked at myself and I said, my goal is to finish well my leg here at Central. And this year is for me, with the 50 years, 40 years, 20 years. Time to hand off.
I'm talking to David Shirey, the retiring senior minister of Central Christian Church in downtown Lexington. COVID changed things for most people in this country and around the world. What about this church and what you do here? How big of a challenge was COVID?
Well, Sam, all of us that are pastors will say we never had a class in seminary about how to serve during a global pandemic. We never learned that lesson. And so this was, as with the rest of our nation and this world, trying to figure out how to do it as we went along. And so, you know, first it became an issue of how do we do church when we can't be together for church? And of course, that led us to explore the ways we could use social media to do our worship services. Thank goodness we have a talented man that grew up in this church, Chris Teasdale, who has been responsible for developing our online worship services, online meetings. Zoom has been a wonderful gift to many of us. But finding a way to do worship without being able to be together was the first challenge. And I spent, you know, a year and a half preaching to a cell phone camera. But I learned during that I have an important voice. And my people, though I could not see them, were telling me week in and week out, we're with you. We recognize that we're joined by the Spirit in cyberspace, if you will. And we need words of assurance, of comfort, of interpretation. Help us to understand what's going on because, as we recognize, COVID was joined as well with the racial injustices that we were trying to address as a nation. My people wanted to hear me talk about that and how we can address it with justice and with care and dignity. So I learned about the importance of my voice. I learned the importance of scripture. I learned the importance of social media used well. You know, this is brand new times for us. The Gutenberg, the printing press led to massive changes in this world, politically and religiously and personally. We're still in the infancy of learning what the social media revolution is going to mean, Sam. And, you know, it also showed me during the COVID years how the resources of our faith really can support and sustain us, give us a measure of equanimity and courage and calm in the midst of crisis. I've had a dictum that I've lived by for a long time, Sam, that I've said, if I'm friended up, read up, run up, and prayed up, I'm up for anything. And I said throughout this pandemic, so that I could be a pastor to my people and a responsible citizen of our city, if I can continue to be in touch with my friends, if I can continue to read widely and carefully, if I can continue to exercise and to pray, I'll be up for this. And I have found that those things were enough.
You are married to Jenny, a musician and teacher, among other things. You have three children. What does this change in your life mean to you and your family?
Well, Sam, I couldn't have had this ministry had Jenny not been the minister that she is in her own right. I mean, we've all heard that stuff about behind every man. Let's stop that stuff. Next to this man, this pastor, is another pastor, and that's my wife, who loves the church, loves reaching out and serving selflessly, has gifts in music and in education, and has poured herself out next to me. She has said, this is going to be different because you and I together have lived our lives in marriage almost exactly 40 years. I met her just as I was beginning my ministry 40 years ago. We're going to be doing things differently, but we both have said, you never retire from following Jesus Christ. And so just as Jenny has walked with me through these years and given herself to the things that she's gifted for, we will find out how we can do that together. Our children, I told them at Christmas time, Sam, I had a little family meeting. I have children in Arizona, Chicago, and Columbia, Missouri. I said, I'm going to retire this year. And they said, oh, Dad, we thought you'd just keep on going forever and we'd have to sort of drag you away. And so I told them the relay versus marathon image, and they said, that's great. You know, we hope you and Mom are just going to continue to enjoy doing life together. So they're all supportive, and Jenny and I are looking forward to what the next opportunities are. Not in full-time ministry, Sam, but just in living out our faith in service of others and in ways that bless God.
David Shirey, thank you, and good luck to you and your family and your retirement and your next steps.
Thank you, Sam. I appreciate your work and your journalism and the chance to sit down and talk with you.
For WEKU and Eastern Standard, this is Sam Dick reporting in Lexington.
Coming up after the break, Bobby Kahn's new novel.
My great-grandfather was a moonshiner.
Cannon Armstrong, owner of the Burl Music Venue in Lexington.
I'm very happy to be here. Talk about myself.
And a new addition to Eastern Standard.
Some people can't escape history. And that's doubly true for Wilmer McLean.
Stay with us for the debut of American Esoterica, hosted by Brian Powers. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
WEKU is supported by Hicks & Funson, Kentucky lawyers Josh Hicks, Greg Funson, Kenny Heumann, Kayla Combs, and Mitch Whitaker provide legal representation for car and truck accidents and other personal injury matters. More information at 859-777-7000. Major support for WEKU comes from Kentucky's Touchstone Energy Cooperatives, supplying reliable power to co-op members across the state. Co-ops are proud to support Ronald McDonald Houses in Kentucky through sponsorship and volunteerism. More information at www.togetherwesaveky.com. And now, back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
When you have an old newspaper clipping featuring a photo of your great-grandfather in prison, his arm around Al Capone, well, there's bound to be a story there. For Bobby Kahn, there sure was. And now it's in her latest book, as you'll hear in the latest from Kentucky Authors Series host Tom Eblin.
Bobby Kahn grew up near Moorhead, Kentucky in the 1980s and graduated from Berea College. As a single mother, she juggled a son and part-time jobs while earning a master's degree in English and creative writing from Eastern Kentucky University. Her debut book was a memoir, In the Shadow of the Valley, published in 2020. It tells of her struggles to get past a childhood of poverty and abuse. Now she has published her debut novel, A Woman in Time. It tells the story of a young woman who challenges the constraints of Depression-era Appalachia. Married to a volatile bootlegger, she struggles with marriage and motherhood while finding solace in the natural world she inherited from her folk healer ancestors. The novel has received glowing reviews from two of today's most acclaimed Appalachian writers, Silas House and Robert Guype. Bobby Kahn is with us today to talk about A Woman in Time. Bobby, welcome to Eastern Standard.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, give us a brief outline and about of the plot of this novel and a little about its main character, Rosalie Carter.
I wrote this book inspired by stories that I grew up hearing about my great-grandparents. My great-grandfather was a moonshiner, and he was in and out of prison. I had a newspaper clipping, or my parents did, that I would look at when I was little of my great-grandpa with his arm around Al Capone in prison. So he enjoyed some benefits from his dealings with moonshine. And of course, that was thriving in Prohibition. So after I finished writing my memoir, I thought I would like to really study a lot more about my great-grandfather's experiences and his prison record and his actual dealings. But as I was imagining what that might look like, I realized that in the stories that I grew up hearing, he was always kind of acclaimed as a hero, like a folk hero for my family. But in reality, he left, you know, children uncared for. And his wife had to fend for herself and for the children while he was in and out of prison, especially during the Great Depression. Of course, that had to be really difficult. And I realized that we have a lot of stories of men like my great-grandfather. And the story that we don't have is that of the women who are in the home trying to pick up the pieces and survive while some of these men are living their very destructive lives and causing a lot of pain. So I decided that I wanted to write a fictional version of my great-grandmother's life. And that's where we get Rosalie. I've incorporated some of the stories that I grew up hearing, which I assume to still be true. But I incorporated those into the plot of this novel and let that guide some of the big events in the characters' lives. And then it's against that backdrop of this really large narrative with a lot of space in between these events that I got to explore what it would have been like to be a woman at that period of time, what a woman's power would have looked like inside the home and outside of the home. And then other things like the way technology and the growing connectedness, even in the 1920s and 30s, how that would have potentially changed life in rural places like Eastern Kentucky.
Well, one of the things that I thought was really fascinating about the novel was kind of the portrait you paint of kind of the lack of agency and self-determination that not only Rosalie has, but, you know, two generations before her, you know, her mother and her aunt and her grandmother who then cares for her. How did you do the historical research to get at those issues?
You know, a lot of that has to do with conversations that I've had with women my grandmother's era and older. I've had some really interesting conversations with some women who would be like my grandmother's age or even a great grandmother's age in relation to me since my memoir came out. And, you know, they've shared stories about what their own lives were like and ways that they were similar to mine, and how they felt unable to share their stories. Some of them to this day feel unable to share their stories because of the impact those stories would have on their families. I also did just, you know, some background research to make sure that my understanding of, you know, what marriage age was like in the 1920s and around that time frame in Eastern Kentucky. And then, you know, I reached out to my mom and stepdad, and they reached out to older aunts to get their perspective, and they recounted their stories. So there was a lot of reaching out and finding, like getting and incorporating personal stories and histories into it, as well as, you know, just looking at historical records to make sure that I got things as accurate as possible from this vantage point.
Yeah, I think Rosalie's 15, I guess, when she is kind of married to her stepbrother.
Yeah. I actually just got a message where someone else was mentioning that as well, and just how hard that is for us to comprehend now, you know, how for most of us, at least culturally, that would be very unacceptable. But, you know, we also know that it was certainly more of the norm in past times and in other places in the world. It still continues to be the norm.
Right. Well, and her social circle was so limited. I mean, there was basically hardly anybody else around, too.
Yeah. I think that's an interesting point about rural living that maybe hasn't been explored, to my knowledge, a whole lot in our books, our media, is, you know, what does it mean when you have such limited options? And, you know, the landscape, the physical landscape is might be vast, but the social landscape is very narrow and limited. So what does that mean for what you can imagine for your possibilities in your life?
Right. What do you want readers to take away from this story?
So I wrote it with the intentions of it being multi-layered. I want it to read as an interesting and compelling story for all readers. And I hope all readers take away some ideas about what it means to, as you mentioned, to have personal agency and what that might look like. What kind of limitations have there been historically that may still exist in our society that you know, we're not always aware of, or we don't always understand exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And then beyond that, I hope that some readers are interested to read it at a deeper level and think about Rosalie's psyche and her psychological development, and how, you know, especially something like getting married against her will at such a young age. What kind of trauma does that represent, and how did that impact her development into a full adult by the time that she actually becomes a true adult? You know, what does that mean? And then, you know, how do we apply that to our thinking about the generations that came before us and what kind of lives they lived with the constraints that they had forced upon them from social expectations and traditions?
Yeah. Well, what are you working on next?
I'm actually working on a story about my mother. I'm not 100% sure yet whether it will be inspired by and be a fictional version as A Woman in Time turned out to be, or if it'll be more true to life. But, you know, she was really interested in being able to explore her story after reading my memoir, and I'm very interested in that as well. I'm really excited to understand what her young life was like better, and already it's helped me realize, like I mentioned, the upbringing in rural Eastern Kentucky, you know, in an era without the internet and without, you know, significant pieces of the highway system and all the connectedness, just what her worldview could have been at that time. And then some of the personal development stuff that we all go through and challenges we all go through, just how those are experienced in very specific ways, depending on, you know, the setting that you find yourself in.
Well, once again, the book is A Woman in Time, a novel by Bobby Kahn. Thank you, Bobby, for joining us today.
Thanks so much.
All right. Well, for Eastern Standard, this is Tom Edlin.
If you're in Central Kentucky and looking for some good live Americana or roots music, you'll want to see who's on the calendar at the Lexington venue, The Burl. Cannon Armstrong, creator and co-owner of the popular Distillery District venue, sat down with Depth of Field series host Dwayne Lundy.
Cannon Armstrong, thank you so much for being on the show.
You're welcome. I'm very happy to be here. Talk about myself.
I guess my first question would be to anybody who owns a club or is on the booking side of the music industry, is why? What was the initial motivation? Because it is certainly one of the most, if not the most difficult part of the music industry.
Because I always wanted to do something that was just, that was going to mean something, honestly. And it was like, you know, all that kind of nags at you for so long. And then you hit a point where, you know, I was at that 35 range, you know, and I just had not done anything. I'd went to law school and I'd accomplished a few things and was working, but it was none of that passion stuff, you know. And music was always sort of the thing, but as some of your early recordings of me will attest, I was never going to be, I was never going to make it as a singer or a guitar player. And so that was like something that I could do that I felt like would contribute.
So the history of that part of Lexington, where the Burl is at, the Distillery District, if you will, was very vacant and or dormant to most of us Lexingtonians for years, if not decades, and then all of a sudden has had this real resurgence. Can you give me a little background into your involvement in the property that now resides the club?
When we first got there, I mean, we were using it as a practice space for my band. From that particular point, you know, that whole area of the Distillery District was really starting to grow. And on the other side of the tracks, you know, the Pepper Campus area that was all being redone, a lot of light over there, a lot of activity. And then across the street, there was nothing except us. And then it sounded good. It felt good. Then we realized, well, what is there in town, really, you know, to... that's happening. You know, it just was timing, man. It's just like everything else. Anytime anybody asks me about the Burl, it is sheer luck and timing that all that stuff worked out.
Yeah. You know, though, the one thing that I admire about what you've done, I've always been a small business guy, and I enjoy that. because you don't get caught in the machinery too much to where it's not flexible and you can't be creative. And there's, you know, there's a certain risk with it. I mean, you really have to sort of, you know, put skin in the game to do it. I look to you as something that I would consider maybe the thing that you do the best is you pivot really well. Like, you get into a situation, you look at it, it has a degree of success or interest to you, and then you branch off. It's really creative and really smart. I've always sort of attested some of that to the fact that you actually own the building itself. Was there any grand plan on, like, you know, you've got the arcade and you've got the other stuff that's sort of happening, or that sprouts into the, you know, the booking side of stuff in places that, it, you know, that's outside of the borough, you know, with Landline Presents?
I don't think there was a grand plan, no. I had been sitting on my hands for that amount of time that was really, like, approaching the end of, like, if I do not do something right now, you know, it's done for me. I just needed to be known for something, and, like, I hadn't done anything. The other things about, you know, I think pivot is a good word. When another opportunity happened, like buying the property, so we bought it, and it was a good price, and we did that all by ourselves. And then when it hit, we had our first show was a sold-out comedian. We had two nights of Trey Crowder, and that was our first show, yeah. And it was sold out. We didn't even have a liquor license. Like, mm-hmm. We had to bring in a caterer. It was just like, I don't know, timing.
Well, timing certainly has a lot to do with the cultural ebb and flow of the music industry and entertainment, genres of music, different people having different influences, and certain things being bigger at one time and struggling at others. And I know that I benefited from the good fortune of the Americana roots indie movement happening in the late 2000s and 2010s up to now. And it would appear that when the Burl opened, the timing for that genre and for the geographical location of where we are seemed to align really, really well. Was that something you were aware of?
Yes and no. You know, when we started the Burl, it was that particular genre of music that, for timing purposes, I had a little bit of vision on it right before it was hit, right before it hit. Americana was going back to a lot of the older country, you know, Willie Waylon, all that stuff, you know, and then even further back than that, you know, Hank Williams, early stuff. Like all that stuff is so timeless that I was like, we need to be somewhere around this stuff. So that, and it wasn't because it was about longevity. It was about money. It was about making sure you can pay your rent every month for the borough.
Yeah.
So I'm like, well, they'll always be bluegrass. They'll always be country music. I didn't want to do pop country music. I didn't want to do stuff like that. So we never booked that. Mm-hmm. But I knew this thing was timeless. So we're going to do that. But there's also this part of me that loves this other music so much, like indie music, even pop music. So I do try to add that more so than I ever did before, because I do think that there's so much stuff out there that's cool, that why can't it be more accessible here? So we try to add that.
Absolutely. Well, speaking of good music here from Kentucky and Lexington specifically, someone who's played the Borough many times, here's Abby Hamilton.
Well, I'd kill for some Tito's and corn chips. Died, I've learned to accept. If it don't make me tired and it don't make me fat, there ain't nothing wrong, I guess. I showed up to work today 4 hours late. Eat a cigarette for breakfast again. Got the fire notice on my office desk. And a middle finger from the Xerox guy.
That was Abby Hamilton. I just saw an amazing show from her down at the Burl about a month ago. We're back with Cannon Armstrong, owner of the Burl. In this time, everybody's, you know, the sort of cliche phrase is, and I think there's value to it since you and I both have had the good fortune of doing it, is, you know, follow your passion, be passionate about something. How long do you think you can keep the passion? And maybe in some ways you've answered the question by creating new avenues to keep yourself interested. But Is there like a long-term sustainability aspect that you're trying to nurture, or you're just living in the moment and sort of going with it?
I had to like say something at my mom and dad's 50th wedding anniversary like 2 days ago. And it really pretty much rings true for me in everything is that I just can't remember a lot of the stuff that's happened. Like, I'm so wrapped up in every day. It's just like, it's the way I'm wired that I just don't do well with trying to reflect, you know, like I have to keep moving. And so I don't really think of it like in the sense of, you know, down the road too hard. Mm-hmm. Now, I remember when we started the Burl, I said, if we'll go 5 years, you know, sure. I don't care what happens after that. Mm-hmm. But now I'm like, it means so much more to so many other people than myself that I'm like, I'm just going to let it live.
I felt very much that same way to a point. And then I got to a certain age and started looking back a little bit more. Communication, you're quite good at it, but for anybody that's starting a business or, you know, maybe struggles with it, is that something that you have found has evolved or retooled since you started? Because now you're navigating so many different things as opposed to, you know, before it was family and maybe one job and a couple of hobbies. Now all of a sudden you've got all this stuff going on. Is that something you're, you know, notice or conscious of?
Well, I mean, like, for me, it was always, I never wanted to be the guy. And you, this is so funny the way you said it earlier, like in a few years, you might be reflective, mm-hmm. you know, and it's like, it's so true what you just said. Like, you don't know what it's like to be your dad until you're actually your dad's age, or you don't know what it's like to be, you know, an experienced entrepreneur until you've actually become an experienced entrepreneur, even if you've succeeded and done things. And then like, you know, there's just phases of life that everybody's already been through. You're really not creating too much that hasn't already happened. Mm-hmm. So like with this, I never wanted to be the guy who wanted to work all the time. And I hate it. I despise that guy, you know, when I was 20. Mm-hmm. Now I do not want to do anything but work all the time. So like I have to balance what I said I would be with what now I want to be. And that for me is what being an entrepreneur is. If you can't apply what you set out to become to now what you want to be, then somewhere you've lost. Right. So that's what I do with any sort of thing.
Do you enjoy communicating with the people that you're working with and the delegating of it? Or is that something you had to learn?
Well, I love that. And delegating is key.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, there's just like so many things that you're doing that if you try to do them all and do everything, you just make everything sort of bad that you're doing.
Take me to like April of 2020. And you're looking at all this, what can people deem or learn from those crisis situations and turning a potentially tragic thing into something positive?
Yeah, I feel like it was in April, so like you had February and then you had March, and then April it was starting to kind of like, oh, what are we going to do, you know? And I feel like, again, it was just luck, like in the sense of that property was set up to do so many different things. We always had the mindset we were going to do outdoor shows. But when COVID happened, it's like everything sped up in our thinking because it was necessity. You know, necessity is, it hadn't invented that idea for us, but it definitely made that idea the only idea. So it was like all or nothing. But again, not every club in America was set up that way to where you could just pivot into the outdoor. So we just did it.
I remember having a very emotional moment.
I did too. I had a couple of them.
I remember seeing Justin Wells, who I've been fortunate enough to work with over the years. And that moment was like something that really hit me in a way that I wasn't expecting. But I went, and it was like a magical thing that you really realize that this is the whole reason why I even do what it is that I do. And you looked out and you saw just people's faces, and I think it meant a lot.
It meant a lot to us.
Cannon, I want to thank you again for coming in, having the presence of the Burl, and what you've brought to Central Kentucky and Kentucky has been a major benefit to music. And I, for one, want to thank you for that as well as joining me. So hope all goes well, and I look forward to seeing you again.
Happy to do it. Always happy to talk with you. Thanks.
And thank you, everybody, for joining me on Depth of Field. I'm Dwayne Lundy. This is WEKU Eastern Standard.
And now, and let's just go ahead and get that drum roll out of the way. In addition to the Eastern Standard lineup, American Esoterica, a podcast by Brian Powers highlighting odd and interesting tidbits of American history.
Some things you just can't escape, whether it's an on-again, off-again relationship, or a particularly annoying debt collector, or that intergalactic bounty hunter. For one man, what he couldn't escape was history, which found him not once, but twice. It didn't just find him, it hunted him. And the result was the creation of an uncanny set of historical bookends in the shape of a man named Wilmer McLean. The First Battle of Bull Run was the first major land battle of the Civil War. The shots at Fort Sumter on April 12, 1861 lit the fuse, but the full powder keg exploded officially when Union troops marched towards Manassas, Virginia, 2 months later in July, in hopes of swiftly defeating the Confederates there. This could open a path to Richmond and deal what might have been a fatal blow to the fledgling army right out of the gate. The Confederate army, however, had been adding reinforcements steadily throughout the fight, and after an early retreat, they gained strength, broke the Union lines, and forced the Union army to retreat all the way back to D.C., running through and over crowds of spectators that had come along to witness what was sure to be an easy victory. It wasn't just the Union army that was getting its share, though. Wilmer McLean, a plantation owner in Manassas, would also soon discover his own breaking point with the war. McLean was a former member of the Virginia militia who had been too old to join the Confederate army. So he stayed at home and oversaw operations on the plantation with his family. His land became the literal epicenter of the First Battle of the Civil War, the First Battle of Bull Run. In fact, at least one account suggests that the very first shot of the battle was a cannonball fired through a kitchen building next to McLean's house. See, when the Confederate Army and General P.G.T. Beauregard showed up weeks before the first battle, he and McLean had become familiar, and a deal was struck whereby the McLean property and buildings would be rented out to the Confederates at the rate of 150 Confederate bucks per month for use as a headquarters and a field hospital, which came in handy when the first Battle of Bull Run took place the very next day. At one point, a cannonball even came through the wall of the dining room and landed in the fireplace while General Beauregard was eating. The Second Battle of Bull Run once again brought war to his doorstep in Manassas, and McLean, now expecting another child with his wife, decided that he had had enough. He moved his family much further away from the front, although it was hard to determine whether the enslaved persons from his plantation were given the same benefit of safety as his family in the move. I don't know how much of the workforce in the new location was brought from the former residents, which continued to use enslaved labor for the benefit of the Confederate Army. In the end, McLean believed that settling in a small village nearly 140 miles away would give his family a respite from war. War, it seems, had other plans. By April 8, 1865, General Robert E. Lee's Confederate troops had been cornered in the small town of Appomattox Courthouse. And yes, that was the name of the village and not a fancy building in a town called Appomattox. There was nowhere left to run. The Union Army had outflanked the rebels and cut off their southern route of escape. Rather than fight, Lee chose to surrender after some exchanged messages with General Ulysses S. Grant. Lee then directed his aide-de-camp, Charles Marshall, the grand-nephew of the great Supreme Court Justice John Marshall, to find a place suitable for the surrender meeting with Grant. Charles Marshall rode out ahead of Lee until he found the very first civilian he could walking along the road to ask him if he knew of a place where the meeting could be held. that very first person he came to? Wilmer McLean. McLean first offered up one of his outbuildings, but it was in a state of disrepair and Marshall rejected it. McLean relented and offered the use of his main house instead. And that's how, on April 9th, 1865, General Grant accepted the surrender of General Lee in the sitting room of Wilmer McLean's house, setting in motion the end of the Civil War. It was a momentous occasion, and many soldiers from both sides popped in to witness the event, including one Robert Todd Lincoln, who was an aide to Grant and also a celebrity offspring. Wilmer McLean, however, was immediately broke. His fortune had all been made in Confederate money, which was now pretty much worthless. And the end of slavery meant the end of cruelly profiting from the efforts of people he had claimed as property. After he noticed Union soldiers stealing things from his house to commemorate the surrender, he started selling his furniture to souvenir seekers with the claim that it was from the very small room where the surrender took place. Rumor has it that he sold enough of that furniture to have filled a good-sized house. So Wilmer had clearly learned a thing or two about making a profit. Despite his Southern sympathies, McLean went on to support Ulysses S. Grant in his 1872 bid for the presidency and even worked in his administration. McLean later died in 1882. Some people can't escape history, and that's doubly true for Wilmer McLean, who saw the Civil War begin in his backyard and end in his parlor. It began with a bang. Lucky for him, it didn't end with one. For more odd and interesting tidbits of American history and culture, you can find the American Esoterica podcast on most major streaming services or visit AmericanEsoterica.com. Thank you for listening. For Eastern Standard, I'm Brian Powers.
That wraps this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer. Neil Kesterson, producing engineer and audio editor. Spencer Shook, intern. Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. We're online at esweku.org. You can check out the Eastern Standard archive, our series, our partners, and more. And you can sign up for our weekly e-newsletter featuring a preview of the next edition. You can also find us on the WEKU app and on NPR One and the Google News app. Want to suggest a topic? Drop us a line at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.